Welcome to the Guardian Mindset Podcast. I'm attorney Eric Daigle. Have you ever heard the quote by Sidney J. Harris that says, "History repeats itself, but in such cunning disguise that we never detect the resemblance until the damage is done"? What does that mean? Well, today's podcast is about history and the purpose of history for Guardian Mindset. See, one of the things about being an attorney is that I get really upset when it comes to the fact that no one pays attention to history, because history matters in my world. Because one of the things that we know is if we don't pay attention to history, as George Santayana said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So you might be saying to yourself, well, Eric, why are we talking about history? What's the purpose of history in a guardian mindset? Well, whether you're a brand new officer or whether you've been on the force for a while, the one thing that is important, I think, is history, because history of good and bad should give you the confidence in order to move forward, to know that you're doing a job that has history behind us. Now, listen, the one thing is clear. History hasn't always been behind us. Unfortunately, history has made us who we are today. You know, in one of the first podcasts, we talked about Sir Robert Peel and the Peel and Principles and the benefit of the Peel and Principles in the Guardian Mindset. But today we're going to talk about history. And the best part about talking about history is it's not a long time. See, if you think about law enforcement, you think about the fact that we've been involved in law enforcement for over 100 years in this country and abroad. But the one thing that's clear is that the history of this country, the history of law enforcement, didn't become applicable until basically 40 years ago. And it's really important that we focus on what has happened in the last 40 years, because those of you that are in law enforcement or joining law enforcement are going to be here for another 20 to 30 years. What I need to do for you is I need to show you that the history is on your side, that we've learned from the history. And sometimes I truly think that people want history to repeat itself. And I don't really think it can or it should. And so for you, if you're sitting there and going, you know, what do I know about the history of law enforcement? Well, it might not be a really aggressive topic or the best topic for a podcast, but I think it's an important topic, because if you don't know where you've been, you're not going to know where you're going. How can I expect you to go out in the street and do the job without knowing that if something goes wrong, the history is on your side? How did we learn to do the job that we do? Now, if you've Googled us by now, you know that our firm is focused on constitutionally based policing correctional application. Our job is to find a way to get you to have the support of necessary policies, training, and supervision to ensure that you can go out there and face all these very difficult situations every day with the best that you have to offer, right? That's the Guardian Mindset application. Well, to talk about history, we're going to start in 1964. And because really, if you look at the history of law enforcement, other than Sir Robert Peel in 1857, there's not too much that applies. Now, the one thing that is clear is that in 1964, we had the race riots, 64 and 65. Now, the benefit and the detriment of the race riots is it was really a very tumultuous time in this country. Now, I wasn't there and you weren't there, but the one thing I do know is that history and the history books show us that we learned a lot from that time. So think about it. Leading up to the race riots in this country, we had police departments that were built, and they were large police departments, especially large city police departments. I mean, policing has been around for a long time. So what is the effect on, and why do we pick the race riots to commence our discussion on history? Because the one thing about the race riots is it was actually a corner turner that we needed, meaning the one thing that we know when we faced with the race riots in 1964 and 65 is that there was deep-rooted hostility. And this deep-rooted hostility between law enforcement and the community they serve. Now, this is not 2021. We're not dealing with all the things that we're talking about in the news today in, you know, post-death of George Floyd and very significant cases that have led to a lot of individuals expressing their desire that either law enforcement should be defunded or disbanded or not even a part of our community. Now, the one thing that is clear, though, is that in the race riots in 1964, nobody then thought they were doing anything incorrect, and nobody then thought they were doing anything wrong. So why do I start there? Well, because if you're working in law enforcement and you don't know this, there's something very important that happens in 1967. In 1967, we have what's called the Kerner Commission, K-E-R-N-E-R. The Kerner Commission was then put in play by then President Johnson. And the purpose of the Kerner Commission was kind of like an after-action review of all the things that happened during the race riots. And by right, there was actually two different applications of analysis that was part of the Kerner Commission. The first part of the Kerner Commission was an evaluation of the criminal justice system. Now, interesting, and we're going to talk a lot about this over weeks of the Guardian mindset. The one thing everyone is clear on is that the criminal justice system is broken. It don't work. It never worked. And fortunately, the problem with the criminal justice system is that, as we know from not only the Kerner Commission, but the President's Task Force report, is that the Kerner Commission identified, or the criminal justice system is identified by the thing that society can see. And the thing that society can see is their police officers. The thing that society can touch, the thing that society can interact with, is their police officers. So the Kerner Commission was designed, but it got called the Kerner Commission because the person who ran the Kerner Commission was Governor Kerner from Illinois. And the first order of business for the Kerner Commission was to examine why there was failures in the criminal justice system. Now, the good part is it didn't take them long to realize that they couldn't possibly examine or identify all the failures in a criminal justice system. Why? Because it's broken, and it's been broken for years. But the Kerner Commission then changed their tune. And the next step to the Kerner Commission was to identify and examine why there was deep hostility between law enforcement and the communities they served. Now listen, there's one thing that history says, and that is we don't want to repeat it. So the one thing that I'm confident on is that we have not repeated it, but there is some concerns to know about what did we learn. Well, the Kerner Commission was forced to look at why there was deep-seated hostility between law enforcement and the community they served. Now think about it. What do we know, at least from history, in 1960s? Well, in the cities, there were neighborhoods that were set up by nationality, right? And that there was very limited crossing between the neighborhoods and the nationalities in which people were raised and brought up in. So police officers were working in these cities, and they were working and interacting with people that they didn't know or have never interacted with before. Now, the key part of this is the Kerner Commission marching under the request of President Johnson, under identifying why race relations were so poor, they came up with three conclusions. Now you can, if you really want, if you got insomnia and you don't really want to sleep, you can, there's a 465 page report on the Kerner Commission. You're more than happy to read the whole thing. In fact, there's even a 25 page summary on the Kerner Commission. But since you're tuned into this podcast, you don't have to do that, because I'll be happy to tell you all about it. See, the Kerner Commission came back and identified three important failures in law enforcement in 1967. And the three failures that we're going to talk a little bit about were professionalism, accountability, and community policing. So professionalism, accountability, and community policing. Well, tell me, if I was to ask you a question, what is professionalism? And what do you define as professionalism? I would expect that people would come back and they would say, well, professionalism is, you know, how we look or how we act. You know, in fact, let's just take a look at what does the internet call? What's the definition of professionalism? And because one of the things that we know in our world that we live in is that professionalism is a very important part. Professionalism is something that we're focused on. Well, what was a dictionary definition of professionalism? Well, the competence or skill expected of a professional. What does that mean? And more importantly, what does a professional in law enforcement look like? You know, how would you describe a professional? And what is the qualities of a professional? You know, when you look online, you say, well, professionalism is the conduct, behavior, and attitude of someone in a work or business environment leads to success. Are you professional? Do you act professional? Do you know people that you work with who don't act professional? That do you know people that don't look or act the way that they should? You know, when we talk about professionalism, it's a word we throw around pretty loosely in law enforcement, right? We want to be considered to be professional. We want to look professional, act professional, be considered professional. But do we want to do the work it takes to be professional? You know, education, environment, self-assessment, self-analysis, really making sure that we're focusing on what is professional. Now, a lot of times in the world of professionalism, you see concepts such as learning and adaptability and integrity. And those are key concepts for us in law enforcement. Those are words that mean something to us. But when we look at professionalism, we know that we've had some challenges over the year. But do you know whether it was our fault? Meaning, do you know whether it was law enforcement's fault that we had professional challenges? Well, let me tell you a little bit about history. See, in the 1960s, the hiring age for law enforcement was usually 18 years old. Now, let me ask you a question. When you hire an 18-year-old, what do you get? Some people would respond back and go, an 18-year-old. Like, great, well, what does that mean? What do you get as an 18-year-old? Well, we now know what that issue looks like. See, we know that in the world of today, we always look at biases. And we look at two types of bias, explicit and implicit bias. And explicit bias, let's start with that. Well, that's racism and sexism. Those are the things that we do not tolerate, right? That's biases that are not allowed. But what is implicit bias? And what is your implicit biases? So when you look at the term implicit bias, one of the things we know about implicit bias is we know that it has a lot to do with how you were raised. It has a lot to do with where you got your information from, right? When we talk about implicit biases in its application, we're talking about, well, where did you learn to be you? And one of the things that you'll say is, well, I learned to be me by my family, you know? When you look at the definition of implicit bias, thoughts and feelings are implicit if we are unaware of them or mistaken about their nature. We have a bias rather than being neutral. We have a preference or an aversion to a group or a group of people. Thus, we use the term implicit bias to describe when we have attitudes towards people or associated stereotypes and them without our conscious knowledge. A fairly commonplace example, as it's seen in studies which show white people who frequently associate criminality with black people without even realizing they're doing it. Now, the question for you is, did you come on the job with implicit bias? And the answer is yes, because everybody goes through life with implicit biases. And what we realized after the Kerner Commission report and having researched the Kerner Commission report, one of the things that was a concept was that 18-year-olds were taken out of their house and they were made police officers. Well, what did they know, right? Like, what did they have for a knowledge base? And if you truly think about it, what they had for a knowledge base was, well, just what their family told them, what they learned. And if we're living in a city with a very structured nationality neighborhood, then what you didn't know is as dangerous as what you do know. So we took these officers and we sent them to the academy, and then we placed them officers in other parts of the cities, in different neighborhoods, with people that they've never known before. Question, does that affect our professionalism? Does that affect how you interact with people? Well, let me just tell you this. There is a way to deal with implicit bias. And do you know what the experts say? Well, there's an expert out there by the name of Malcolm Gladwell. And what Gladwell says is that to defeat implicit bias, we have to have contact theory, which means in order to get rid of your implicit biases, you have to have contact and allow yourself to integrate with people that you may not be familiar with. Now, the one thing that we learned over the years is that we got to stop hiring 18-year-old cops. And the reason why was because, well, they didn't have any life experience. So then we took our 18-year-old officers after the Kerner Commission report, and we raised the age to 21. Now, listen, I'll be very honest with you. I have a very personal opinion, and that is I believe that police officers should have an educational requirement, whether it's an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. I just believe that that's the way of the world. But I do understand one thing, and that is not everybody has the same life opportunities. So what I really care about is, well, let's raise the age to 21, which we did, and then let's evaluate what they do between the age of 18 and 21. In fact, people ask all the time, police chiefs ask me, Eric, what are you looking for when you hire a police officer? Well, what I'm looking for is I'm looking for someone with experience in other race, creed, colors, national origins, sexual orientation. I want people that have interacted with those that may push what they know. Now, experience, because I was, 17 years old when I went to boot camp in Fort McCallum, Alabama. I think military does a great job of that because you're all just living together and you all got to either make it together or you're not going to make it together. But that does a great ability to limit implicit bias. The business world, college, volunteering, there's a lot of things that can make you more effective in the world of implicit bias. So number two, accountability. And this is the most important thing that people don't understand is when they look at the history of this country in law enforcement, they realize that up until about 1970s, when we talk about accountabilities, there was not a really guiding process to help us out. Because even if you are if you're on the job and you know because you've been through all the training, take a look at all the court cases that govern what we do on a daily basis. You could look back into the 60s, sometimes into the 50s, when you find cases related to search and seizure or the Fifth Amendment. These cases, they really start to build up in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Even our use of force cases today, Graham versus Connor and Tennessee versus Garner. Well, these are cases that came out in the 80s, 1985, 1989. That's a big difference, isn't it? This wasn't just born and raised in 1930. The problem that our society needs to understand is that the structures are new and we are learning by them. But the most important thing that society needs to know is that we have these structures and these structures are very sound. So accountability. The Kerner Commission said we better have better policies, better training, better supervision, internal affairs, discipline, all these things that we call accountability. And then community policing. We really got to go out there and develop in the community policing world. Now, the thing is that we're going to talk about law because the history of law matters. And the one thing that we know is that law guides what we do in law enforcement. See, this makes us different than any other industry in the country because there is no other industry in the country that is guided by law. And the problem with that is a twofold problem. The first problem is that we have to have the law in order to have the guidance, right? The second problem is that other industries have national set of standards that give guidance to how to do the job, but we don't have that here. We have limited accreditation and applicable standards, but our job is controlled by law, and law is a living document. It's a continued interpretation, and sometimes it takes a while to get a base standard. So what do we know? Well, we know the law makes the policy makes the training, and the training guides our operations. But as we look at the law, we really start to look at the outcome of the Kerner Commission in 1967. Now, the problem with the outcome of the Kerner Commission in 1967 was that it wasn't law. See, it was recommendations. And the problem with recommendations is it's not law. And that means we don't have to do it if we don't want to. So it really wasn't until 1978 when the Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called Monell versus Department of Social Services. Now, Monell is a very important case for our operations. Now, one of the things that I say to society or to anybody who challenges, well, why do we do certain things? And what makes sure that we do them the correct way? And my answer is always the same, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in the ruling in 1978 in Monell versus Department of Social Services said that there is an applicable standard for municipal and governmental units when they don't do things correctly, and if the fact that they're not doing it correctly leads to a violation of constitutional rights for citizens, then that's a failure on our part. And so under Monell liability, which we call the Powerball, it's kind of like, you know, in the game of lottery, when you hit the Powerball, what happens? Well, if you win the lottery and then you win the Powerball, bam, you win a whole ton of money, right? And that's exactly what's occurring here in this application, which is, yes, you can be sued for violating someone's constitutional rights, such as excessive force or false arrest or bystander liability. Those are violations of law. But if the violation of law uncovers what we call a pattern or practice, meaning that there's a way of doing business that has led to the deprivation of someone's constitutional rights, then the Powerball is activated. That means that somebody can make millions of dollars off of something that normally would have just been a payday of a few hundred thousand or even less. Those things are called, and in the Monell liability application, what the court says is that law enforcement agencies, municipal governments, correctional agencies, they can be sued for constitutional deprivations visited pursuant to governmental custom. Now think about that for a while. Custom. What is a custom? Now you're working on the job. What would you call a custom? Well, one of the things that I say in training all the time is that I hear officers use this term all the time. Hey, why'd you do that? Well, it's the way we do it here, or it's always the way we do it. Well, that doesn't make it right. And that actually causes me greater concern, because if I've asked you how you do something and you don't know how you do it, that means you don't know why you do it. And one thing I'll be very clear with you on is that if you don't know why you're doing it, stop doing it. Because if you don't know why you're doing it, that means when you do it, somebody someday is going to say to you, hey, why'd you do that? Why'd you do it that way? And if you don't understand why you're doing it or why you're doing it that way, you don't have an answer. And if you don't have an answer, then you don't have you don't have an explanation. And it could lead to the fact that if that outcome is determined to be a violation of someone's constitutional rights, then you're going to have a failure on your part, and you're really going to be in harm's way. So what we're talking about here is custom. We don't want customs. Or what is a custom? Well, a custom is a thing that we do all the time. And how many times in your department has somebody said those words? Well, this is the way we do it here, kid. Maybe that was just my age, because they always added the word kid. But the problem is, what our job is that we're the new breed of law enforcement. So the one thing I want you to be aware of is I don't want you doing things unless you know why you're doing them. And that's really important in my world when we're building policy manuals for departments. You know, we got to have a reason for why we're putting stuff in policy. It's just not, in 2021, the one thing that's important about the history of this job is it's just not about blindly following people anymore. You know, it's understanding what this job is about, understanding the good, the bad, understanding the history, understanding the failure, and understanding the success, which is about time to talk about some success. Well, we know that 1978, the Supreme Court in Monell versus Department of Social Services gave us some law. Now, the difference between Monell liability and the Kerner Commission was, just as I said, Monell is law, and the Kerner Commission was recommendations. So now we're into 1978, 1980s. Now we're going to start doing things correctly, and it's not because we want to. It's because the law said if you don't, you're going to pay out significant damages to the individuals in whom you harm. So we really started focusing on alleviating or eliminating what we call deliberate indifference. Oh, that's in the fancy word. What does it mean? Well, it means that you knew better. deliberate indifference, doing something that you knew you shouldn't have done, but you do it anyway. So policies, training, supervision, internal affairs, all the things that make up your department are there for a very specific purpose. They are checks and balances to ensure that you can survive that bad day. Well, what we do know also is this, is that we've already had a test, and it's not George Floyd. It really came in somewhere about 2015, or actually it came in the summer of 2014 with the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Now listen, if you're listening to this podcast, this is not new to you. And by the way, I will tell you that nowadays, as we sit here in 2021, you can watch and listen to and read everything from the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And the interesting part is that it's almost part of our history to the point where we should be, because it's not the shooting death of Michael Brown that became a challenge, because listen, that incident could have happened anywhere in the country. What became a challenge was it enhanced the constitutional deprivations or the pattern and practice failures of the Ferguson Police Department. They had some problems, and you can read that in all of the documents associated with Department of Justice investigation of Ferguson. In fact, there's a report out there called the Investigation of Ferguson Police Department. It's a Department of Justice March 4th, 2015 Department of Justice report. So you can feel free to evaluate and review. And in fact, if you go to the DLG Learning Center and you look at our articles, you can search the Ferguson report and a little summary will pop up. But the good thing about the Ferguson report is that it really told us what were the things that we as management and law enforcement need to focus on. The Ferguson report focused on six things. And it's six very important things that you should make sure in your daily world that you're understanding how and why it occurs. Because these things are here for not only your protection, but also the protection of the community to ensure that constitutional protections are afforded. The six things that the Ferguson report focused on was bias-based policing. And not that it occurs, but what we can do to prevent it, to make sure that we have proper policies and training in place, to make sure that we are auditing ourselves, to make sure that we understand who we stop, when we stop them, where we stop them, why we stop them, and that they can pass the smell test of bias-based policing, because we're not going to tolerate bias-based application. Use of force reporting and investigation. Just using force in and of itself, hey, that's legally justified in order to protect yourself and protect others, but it does come with an after-action analysis. And the good part of that after-action analysis is that we want to make sure that you're doing it correctly. Make sure that you understand the requirements of using force. Nothing in this process says you can't use force. Law provides you the ability to use force to protect yourself or others, but it must be done within the constitutional safeguards of the law as it's been identified. And so how do we evaluate that? Well, we do use the force after action reviews and investigations to make sure that your decision-making and judgment meets the requirements of the law. Proper supervision and the importance of supervisors to really understand how important their job is and to make sure that they're holding people accountable. More importantly, it's not all about holding people accountable. You know, I have a very, I like a little saying it uses with supervision. And what is the requirements of supervision? Well, if you look at Department of Justice consent decrees, what you'll see is that it all starts with the supervisors. And that departments shall ensure that supervisors have the knowledge, skills, and ability to provide close and effective supervision to each officer under the supervisor's direct command, and provide officers with the direction and guidance necessary to improve and develop as police officers, to identify, correct, and prevent officer misconduct. The goal here of the supervisors is to make sure that they're providing direction and guidance necessary to make officers better. And more importantly, one thing that I truly believe in is that we want to improve and develop you as police officers. And by doing so, we must evaluate, identify, correct, and prevent officer misconduct. Now, Investigation complaints of misconduct. The Ferguson report also identified the importance of investigating complaints of misconduct. Now, most of you, especially if you're officers, the one thing you always have a natural reaction to is, man, why are we always out there asking for complaints of misconduct? You know, you're always just trying to get the citizens to tell us what we did wrong. And you know what? In my opinion, that can't be further from the truth. The benefit of the checks and balance system is to make sure that, one, we are doing things right. And if society feels like they're not been treated properly, then file the complaint because we're going to make sure that they were treated properly. And majority of the time, I'm pretty confident in the fact that you do treat them properly. So the findings of the report will support you if the outcome is something that an individual wants to press with a lawsuit or future allegations. Training. How important is training? And we're going to spend some time on training. More importantly, we're going to spend some time identifying these areas on their success. And community policing. Listen, community policing is not a program. It's not something that we can give you a book on. Community policing and police legitimacy is go out there and do the job. And do it with the trust and respect so that you can treat people correctly in the process. Now, this leads us to the last important process of this podcast, and that is the President's Task Force Report. Well, we're going to talk about the President's Task Force Report, but if you've never heard about it, I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of looking. And what does that mean? Well, in May of 2015, after the shooting death of Michael Brown in 2014, President Obama, by executive order, opened what's called the President's Task Force for 21st Century Policing. Now, the purpose of this was that they were going to evaluate the actions of law enforcement. In fact, history is repeating itself again. See, think about it. 1964 race riots, 1967 Kerner Commission, after every big event is evaluation time. So 2014 shooting death of Michael Brown, 2015 President's Task Force Report. Do you know what the outcome of the President's Task Force Report was? Do you know after they evaluated actions of law enforcement in the process, in the development of law enforcement agencies, how we do things, why we do things, and whether we're doing things constitutionally sound or for the right reasons at the right time. Do you know what the outcome was? Well, you're probably by now saying, man, I probably should know what the outcome is. But don't worry, we're going to go into detail. We're going to talk about this report in a very detailed application. But one of the things I want you to be aware of is that, well, you can go online and watch the videos. This was 4 6-hour blocks where a panel interpreted and asked questions of all the experts in the country related to law enforcement operations. And the question in 2015 is, hey, what's wrong with law enforcement? Why are they doing things wrong? And do you know what the outcome was, though? Do you know what the outcome? Did they find that we were doing things wrong? No, in fact, they didn't find that. And if you read the 2015 overarching recommendations from the report, the first and number one overarching recommendation was that the president should support and provide funding for the creation of a national crime and justice task force to review and evaluate all components of a criminal justice system for the purposes of making recommendations to the country on comprehensive criminal justice reform. Now, what does that mean? Well, they said to us, hey, let me tell you what we found. We said, go ahead, tell us. They said, we found that the mental health industry is broken. Yes, of course it's broken. You closed all the treatment facilities. You don't have any, all these people have no place to go. And officers are dealing with them on the street every day. They said, we think that the criminal justice system is broken. And we went, yeah, it's been broken for 30 years. They said, well, how about we think prosecution is broken, prosecutorial application. We said, yes. Judicial is broken. We said, yes. That corrections is broken. We said, yes. We think parole and probation is broken. We said, yes. And they said, you know what? We think that there's actually a problem in social application. Basically what they said is, in this country, we're not giving our citizens what they need. In fact, the report said these exact words. The president should promote programs that take a comprehensive and inclusive look at community-based initiatives that address the core issues of poverty, education, health, and safety. These are not law enforcement problems. These are societal problems that law enforcement is faced to deal with. And we want to find ways to make sure that you have the tools in your toolbox to deal with these. So we'll be coming back and we'll be dealing with the six pillars for fundamental and fair and effective policing. Pillar one, building police, building trust and legitimacy. Pillar two, policy and oversight. Pillar three, technology and social media. Pillar four, community policing and crime reduction. Pillar five, training and education. Pillar six, officer wellness and safety. I truly believe, as you sit here today, that every officer needs to understand the President's Task Force report, needs to have a working knowledge of the 78 recommendations in that report, and needs to understand how the six pillars are placed to build up a protective entity around the officers to ensure that they have the skills, the ability, and the knowledge to conduct this job in a sound and bias-free manner. Now, we're going to get really detailed on this as we go forward. But between now and then, I recommend you might want to peek around. If you got some extra time, take a look at the president's report. Look at the pillars. And when we come back, we'll break those down and we'll get some insight from the best in the industry as to how those pillars will become the future of policing. Because it's not about a policy. It's not about training. It's not about supervision. It's about putting them all together to have an effective constitutional operation that allows you as the officer to go out and do the job every day and understand what the margins of good and bad behavior are. So with that, I'll leave you, and I can't wait to see you next time. And I'll end as I always do. Help those who need your help. Protect those that need your protection. And most importantly, keep yourself and others safe. Thank you.